loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou, and joined in studio by Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, it is widely believed that the final report from the Mueller probe will be submitted next week. Next, we'll take a look at the landmark Supreme Court ruling against civil asset forfeiture. Then, a new alliance has emerged in Israel that threatens to unseat Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but still subscribes to fundamentally the same colonial ideology. And then, as the fight against ISIS appears to wind down, intense controversy has emerged over the fate of those who joined the organization and now want to return home. And finally, we continue our regular weekly segment, Veterans for Peace. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo today ruled out running for the Senate in the 2020 election. Speculation has been mounting that he would stand down from his role in the administration to campaign for the open seat in Kansas. But Pompeo insisted today that, quote, "I'm going to be the Secretary of State as long as President Trump gives me the opportunity to serve as America's senior diplomat." According to a court document released today, President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, will be sentenced on March 8th for bank and tax fraud. His sentencing on these charges will come just a few days before his scheduled sentencing for lobbying violations, which will be held on March 13th. Iran began military exercises in the Strait of Hormuz and the Sea of Oman today in a show of force designed to deter a possible U.S. attack on the country. A newly unveiled submarine capable of firing cruise missiles will take part in the drills for the first time. The war games comes just days after a U.S.-hosted conference in Poland aimed at building international support for regime change in Iran. U.S. officials today said that a key part of the upcoming Vietnam summit between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will be developing a common understanding of what denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula means. The official said that the removal of U.S. troops from South Korea was not a subject of the discussion. The summit will take place next week in Vietnam on Wednesday and Thursday. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Mueller probe. It is widely believed that the final report from the Robert Mueller probe report will be submitted next week. The investigation has led to a string of indictments, but mostly relate to lying to the FBI and other crimes, not necessarily connected, well, not connected at all so far, to collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia, that which started the probe. What can we expect and what impact will it have on U.S. politics and its foreign policy? We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. She is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Colleen Raleigh, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
It's been 2 years. It seems that this is really coming to an end, that a number of the investigators who had private practice or were DOJ attorneys have been returned to their firms or to their earlier posts. It's coming to an end. What do you expect if you can make out any of this by reading the tea leaves?
Well, I think it's not going to be any surprises. I think over the last 2 years, really, we've had a lot of this has either leaked out or the indictments themselves, the charges have furnished the information. So I would expect it to be pretty short and maybe just a sum up, because those charges that Mueller got, which, again, while they don't relate to Trump's collusion necessarily, they do indict Russia, you know, as having meddled in the election. And I think the media will run with whatever Mueller comes up with, even if there is really nothing new in the report. I expect the media, just in line with how it's been going, is going to make a big deal out of any little tidbit in there, even if there is some little new tidbit. Otherwise, they'll just rehash it again. Mueller doesn't necessarily have to find any collusion between Trump and and Russia, Russian officials, because the media is doing that for him. So he can have, you know, a modicum of integrity there and not really make any kind of those, you know, far ranging conclusions, because the media is doing that job itself.
Right. So the probe that has dominated public news and the narrative and certainly the discourse in the country, which was, did Russia collude with Donald Trump in the 2016 campaign? Is Donald Trump, at least in part, president of the United States because of Russia? What you're suggesting is he might not point to any of that that actually indicates that or shows any direct connection with the Russian government, or if there was, that it had any impact. And yet you're saying he doesn't really need to because the narrative itself is the dominant thing. It's not really about the probe. But under those circumstances, would one conclude that it might have been a waste of time and money?
Yeah, I don't necessarily. If you look in hindsight now at that whole firing of Comey and then McCabe launching a counterintelligence investigation of Trump, that was all aired, you know, on 60 Minutes a couple of days ago. There's a former assistant U.S. attorney by the name of Andrew McCarthy, who was a former prosecutor of terrorism in New York City. He's been around the block and he knows all of these figures pretty well. He knows how the games are played. He's very right wing and kind of aligned with the neocons and pro-war. So I really don't like the guy. I kind of even knew him a little bit in New York City when I worked there. So for a lot of reasons, I'm not a big fan of Andrew McCarthy. However, I think he does have the interpretation, explanations of what went on with the Department of Justice, certain officials, and the FBI, and even CIA and NSA to some extent, even before the election, when they decided to launch these counterintelligence investigations of Trump. And McCarthy says this wasn't just merely of campaign officials. They were hoping that incidentally they would find Trump. And I think that's exactly right. Now that that hasn't happened, they have to then fall back and try to, you know, protect themselves, protect people like McCabe and others that are in a little bit of trouble. And I think that Mueller probably isn't willing to go so far as to really, you know, make up and conclude things that the evidence doesn't show. You know, again, former prosecutor McCarthy's right. There is no evidence for this collusion. And so he'll just put in what he already has in terms of charges and then rely on the media to return to the same old narrative, the Russiagate, what people call the Russiagate narrative. And unfortunately, that shows no signs of stopping at all. So this report will furnish a little red meat for that to be rehashed. I'm sure it will be mostly rehashed. And unfortunately, with foreign policy, that's the problem, is it really has a lot of dangerous aspects for our foreign policy. And we are ramping up Cold War, new arms race. The population, the American population, has almost been put into a mindset of war or preparing for war with not only Russia, too, but, you know, China and others. So that's really unfortunate. And I think that the sad thing is that none of the real Russiagate collusion was ever true. There were some people that, of course, pointed this out. Woodward pointed it out, but it just, the media doesn't want to hear that.
We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. Colleen is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. Real quick, I have two more questions for you, and time is running fast. One of them is, do you believe, based on your own experience with the FBI, that when Andrew McCabe says, as he says in his book and also on 60 Minutes, that he instigated a FBI investigation of whether Donald Trump was a Russian asset after the firing of by Trump of James Comey, the FBI director? Some people say, well, that is actually an attempt by the FBI, by an intelligence agency, to actually carry out its own insertion into the political process, in effect, carry out a coup d'etat. Again, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump, but do you see it that way?
Again, this is what former assistant U.S. Attorney McCarthy pointed out. He's exactly right. In a counterintelligence investigation, which is what McCabe launched after Comey was fired, that is for the purposes of educating and informing Trump, so that he can, in theory, make smart decisions about foreign policy. In the FBI, a supervisor can shut down a counterintelligence investigation. But what McCabe was saying in his interview with Pelley was that the president can't shut it down, even though a counterintelligence investigation is solely to inform the so-called commander-in-chief. So that really, literally, the only interpretation is that McCabe actually does believe that somehow the FBI is in control and that the president isn't in control of foreign policy. That's the only interpretation you can have of what he said. Again, I don't like or agree with Andrew McCarthy in a lot of respects, but if you read his last couple of articles especially interpreting McCabe's interview, I think he's exactly right on this, because Cabe, along with Brennan and Clapper and others, after a while, they start to believe that they are the ones who know more about foreign policy. If they get someone like George Bush Sr., who was himself the CIA director, they probably wouldn't have those notions, you know, because George Bush had worked in intelligence, etc. But especially when they get someone like an Obama, and or certainly like Trump, where they think, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, we're going to have to educate that guy. And when they have trouble, quote unquote, educating the president, then they believe, oh, okay, he's not listening to us, we have to take over. And I think that's exactly what happened with Trump.
Last question, Colleen Rowley. Will the report be made public? Will William Barr, the new attorney general, make it public? Of course, it's his decision. That's the question, at least, that's dominant in the mainstream media. And if he didn't, why wouldn't he? About 45 seconds left.
I think the public, especially the Russiagate support people, will complain no matter how much he makes public. And he will be wise to make as much of it public as possible. And maybe if there is something really juicy in there that he doesn't want to make public, he might not. However, there's going to be an outcry by not making it public. So I think he'd be wise to make most of it public.
All right, we'll leave it right there. We were joined from Minnesota by Colleen Rowley. Colleen is a former FBI special agent. In 2002, she was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. In a rare unanimous decision from the Supreme Court, the practice of civil asset forfeiture was declared unconstitutional in most instances. This is a major victory for advocates who have long argued that the civil asset forfeiture was little more than a mechanism for police agencies to steal from the general public and especially from working class and poor communities. We are joined from West Palm Beach, Florida, by Brad Schlesinger. He is an appellate attorney licensed to practice in the Supreme Court. Brad, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
There's different elements of this case. This was a unanimous decision. That might be important. But let's just talk about what the case actually was, who was the plaintiff, and what happened to that person, and what does the Supreme Court decision mean for him, and does it have broader implications?
Well, it sure does have broader implications. The case was a gentleman by the name of Timms, who was arrested for allegedly selling heroin to an undercover officer. He eventually pleaded guilty to those drug charges, and the state instituted what they typically do to criminal defendants is forfeiture proceedings. They civilly tried to obtain this person's vehicle, who they claim was used for the selling of drugs. The only problem here, and what the Supreme Court found to be the serious issue, was the fact that the maximum fine that he could have faced from the conviction was a pittance and compared to the value of the vehicle. The value of the vehicle was some $40,000, whereas the maximum fine, I think, was somewhere around $5,000 or $10,000. So what the Supreme Court is basically saying is that the excessive fines clause in the Eighth Amendment applies to the states through the 14th Amendment, which should have been assumed and accepted for many, many, many years, but it doesn't work that way. The court has been applying rights from the Bill of Rights to the states, the 14th Amendment, in a very long and piecemeal fashion. But this is a very, very, very positive development in the terms for criminal justice reform, because like you mentioned, civil asset forfeiture is essentially state-sanctioned theft from individuals. And while this opinion doesn't kill civil asset forfeiture completely, what it does do is it gives the people who are trying to fight civil asset forfeiture a lot more in their own barrels to fight back against the state, and it essentially now will open up the courts for a lot more challenges against this stuff.
How important has civil asset forfeiture and seizure of assets been for financing local government and local police departments?
It's played a huge role. A lot of these local police departments, they see civil asset forfeiture as a way to boost their own budgets without having to get money from the state. And it creates incredibly perverse incentives. So if you're a local police department and you want to get some fancy equipment from the federal government and your state's not budgeting for it and you don't have the funds to do that, well, the best way to go do that is to go out and police what you would call crimes where you can obtain people's property, which would be to say police for drug crimes. And so you pull people over, you find drugs, you take whatever cash they may have, whatever property they may have, you sell it, and these departments use these funds themselves. And I'm sure you can imagine that often these funds aren't used for community-based outreach programs or things of that nature. They're used to buy tanks and send chiefs of police and captains on vacations and for expensive plane tickets. So it's not exactly like they're using this money to reinvest it into the community or community policing programs. They're using it for their own. They're using it as their own personal piggy bank.
Yeah, that's so important. You know, we were talking earlier today with Paul Wright and Kevin Gostala in a segment we call Criminal Injustice. We talked about what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, for instance. That was the place where the new Black Lives Matter movement started in 2014 after the killing of Michael Brown. Of course, the black community was outraged by this police killing and many other acts of police violence conducted or committed in the black community that go unpunished. But another part of the story was just how excessive fining is used by the police department against principally black people in the city of Ferguson. In 2013, the municipal court in Ferguson, a city of 21,135 people, issued 32,975 arrest warrants for nonviolent offenses, mostly driving violations. And these were not after convictions necessarily. In other words, people had not yet been found guilty and thus were presumed innocent, but 32,000 arrest warrants in a city of 21,000. And then people couldn't pay fines and their stuff was seized or they had additional fines. It seemed like just a huge churning of money from the policed black community by the police themselves. In other words, the people who were more or less the victims of over-policing had to pay for it.
Right. It creates this incredibly vicious cycle. The court system is looking at defendants as the people who are going to pay those fines and court costs to sort of keep the system running. The police are looking at those people as targets who they can arrest and imprison and take their property to fund their own personal projects. And what you have are poor people and minorities caught in the middle who are caught up in this vicious cycle. They're the ones who are getting arrested, facing these fines. And when they can't pay them, like you said, their driver's license gets suspended, and then they can't get a job, or their car gets taken away, or their wages are garnished. It really is this horribly perverse process that really can't be looked at independently of the sort of overtly racial aspect of the war on drugs, because what we have is a system that is creating the incentives for police to ignore the kind of crimes that are based on community safety, say murders, rapes, assaults, things of that nature, and to police for crimes where they know that there could be a financial windfall for them. And so it results in over-policing of poor and minority neighborhoods, because police know that poor people and people who mostly reside in minority communities may not have the means to fight back, because the police departments are hiring civil law firms to proceed against people in these forfeiture proceedings. And it costs a lot of money to fight back. And because it's in the civil arena, you typically don't have the right to a lawyer to represent you, and you're kind of on your own. They also assume, like this gentleman, Mr. Timms, who just won the case, that he probably wouldn't be able to produce a receipt to show, you know, that he legitimately purchased the vehicle. So they're banking on this information and targeting communities of color and communities of low income status because they know that they almost don't have any real way to fight back.
Brad Schlesinger is our guest. He's an appellate attorney. We're talking about the Supreme Court decision, a unanimous decision supporting the claim of a plaintiff whose Land Rover vehicle worth $42,000 was seized for a drug crime, the maximum penalty for which was $10,000. The Supreme Court decision was unanimous. Brad, President Trump says now that he's declared a national emergency and he's going to pay $6.7 billion to build the wall at the U.S.-Mexican border, about 8% of that money, $600 million, according to Trump, will come from the Treasury Department's forfeiture fund made up of proceeds from cash, cars, and other property forfeited during investigations carried out by the Treasury Department and the Department of Homeland Security, which includes the Secret Service, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that's ICE, Border Patrol, and the Coast Guard. So this ruling applies to states, but it doesn't really touch the federal forfeiture program. Is that correct?
It doesn't, the ruling doesn't put a kibosh on what we would call the federal equitable sharing program that the federal agencies work in concert with local police officers. What it should do, though, is open up access for people who have had their money taken in those processes from federal agencies and fight to get their stuff back. They should be able to file lawsuits, and there should be, I would guess, a flood of litigation in federal courts to sort of determine who and when their people have had their constitutional rights violated by asset forfeiture. And I would suspect that any attempt that Trump may have to get his hands on some of those dollars will probably not only be enjoined by the courts because he's overreaching in his federal authority, but maybe a litigant brings a matter in federal court regarding federal civil asset forfeiture, and the lower courts can sort of put a hold on any use of those funds until the determination of, you know, what is and what was not constitutional can be determined.
Brad Schlesinger is our guest. Brad, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Judge Ginsburg, wrote the opinion, there was a concurrent opinion by Clarence Thomas. Again, this was a unanimous decision, something quite unusual for the Supreme Court. In her opinion, Ginsburg wrote, following the Civil War, Southern states enacted black codes to subjugate newly freed slaves and maintain the pre-war racial hierarchy. Among these laws, provisions were draconian fines for violating broad proscriptions on vagrancy and other dubious offenses. Black people in the South were charged with all of these so-called crimes like being unemployed or vagrant or anything. Big fines were imposed on them. They couldn't pay them. And then the state, the government, would hire them out, lease them out to private farmers or plantation owners. In other words, the re-enslavement of black people. Here we are in 2018. This system, while modified in some ways, has continued. Anyway, we have 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to look at the carceral state and see it as anything other than a new form of slavery or social control of black and brown communities. And whether it's prison sentences or these excessive fines and sort of like the new debtor's prison that we're seeing, there's really no way to look at the criminal justice system and see it as anything other than a racist operation meant to continue the social control over minorities at the expense of the white power class.
We were joined from West Palm Beach, Florida, by Brad Schlesinger. He is an appellate attorney licensed to practice in the Supreme Court. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. A new alliance has been formed by the former head of the Israeli military and the leader of a smaller so-called centrist political party to take on Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in upcoming elections. In response, Netanyahu has even further embraced the extreme right wing of Israeli politics. We're joined from Palestine, from Bethlehem, by Miko Peled. Miko is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Brian.
Likewise. Thank you so much. I'm looking at the Washington Post. Netanyahu's election rivals merge as Israeli leader makes pact with extreme right. And then the article begins with a recitation from a number of supporters of the state of Israel in general here in the United States, people from the Jewish community who are highly critical of Netanyahu's decision to merge with the ultra-right. Let's just talk about what these new constellations actually mean.
Well, you know, Netanyahu is extreme right, except he's got better manners than these other guys. So, I mean, the connection between him and Smotrich and some of these others that he's just made the alliance with is perfectly natural. Now, the mood in Israel is the farther right you are, the better chance you have of succeeding in the elections. So politically, what he did makes sense. Ideologically, what he did makes sense. And there's a wonderful cartoon by Carlos Latouf, the great cartoonist from Brazil, where he shows Rabbi Kahana, the fascist neo-Nazi Jew, who comes back, emerges from the dead, you know, kind of in a halo, and he shakes hands with him, and he says, "Finally, I found my running mate, my real partner." You know, I think the alliance politically makes absolute sense.
We're speaking with Miko Peled. We're talking to Miko from Bethlehem. We're talking about the upcoming Israeli elections. What about the candidates who are blocking together to oppose Netanyahu? Let's talk about them. Let's politically characterize them, if you would.
Well, they're all fighting to prove who is more right wing than the other, and of course Netanyahu brilliantly outrighted all of them. So he wins in that category, and now they pretend somehow it's one party of generals and former chiefs of staff of the IDF and another party of a man who's dedicated to destroying the ultra-Orthodox Jewish community, the indigenous ultra-Orthodox community here in Jerusalem. They're nothing centrist about them. They're as right-wing as you can get. But I think Netanyahu is going to defeat them quite easily. They're not as intelligent as he is. There's not as politically savvy as he is, and they've got no accomplishment, no achievement. And I think in the end, they're all going to be begging him for a job, just like they always do.
Again, I'm going to read to you Miko Peled from The Washington Post. Former Army Chief of Staff and political newcomer Benny Gantz and Netanyahu's longtime opponent Yair Lapid, who have been polling in second and third place respectively, announced that they would join forces to run on a joint party list, ramping up pressure on the incumbent leader as he battles corruption allegations. What you're saying to us is that this isn't really going to be a serious contest, nor do they actually offer any kind of genuine centrist alternative to this far-right alliance between Netanyahu and, well, people who are like Kahane, Rabbi Kahane. They're basically racial supremacists. But you're saying it's not really fundamentally different.
No, they're not fundamentally different at all. I mean, Benny Gantz himself, he kicked off his campaign with a video showing how much death and destruction caused in Gaza, you know, taking pride in horrific war crimes and the killing of countless civilians and destruction of civilian infrastructure in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. So number one, he's taking pride in a war crime. Two, he's taking pride in something that he was told to do by his boss, Netanyahu, because Netanyahu was a minister and Gantz was a soldier. So even if the things he's taking pride in were not things that he had any part in deciding upon, this is policy that was set upon Netanyahu. And that's the kind of small-minded politicians that these people are. They're no match for Netanyahu, and they're certainly not any less right-wing and any less extremist. Except they have better manners, and they don't perhaps look quite as menacing as some of these other people that Netanyahu chose to align with.
One of the parties that Netanyahu is aligned with is called Jewish Power. It's sort of a rebranding of Kahane's Koch Party. It was outlawed in Israel in 1994 after Baruch Goldstein, one of the party members or supporters, killed 29 Palestinians as they prayed in Hebron. I'm looking, Miko, at the Jewish American magazine Forward. It compared Netanyahu's deal to align with these parties as to the equivalent of striking. They called it the Israeli equivalent of the Ku Klux Klan. Do you agree with that?
Well, I would say it's probably the Israeli equivalent of the Nazi party. But politically and, well, ideologically, there is no difference between them and Netanyahu. I think Netanyahu would not publicly come out and congratulate them for what Baruch Goldstein did. But obviously, ideologically, he sees no problem with it. And it's interesting, or cynical, actually, that this alliance is being done 25th anniversary, almost to the day of the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre, in which this Jewish terrorist fascist Baruch Goldstein went into the Ibrahimi Mosque and started spraying with a machine gun and killing countless numbers of praying unarmed Palestinians. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think this is probably one of the ways in which Netanyahu is allowing them to celebrate that accomplishment. Well, what they see as an accomplishment.
That's the voice of Miko Peled. He joins us from Bethlehem. Miko is the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. Miko, Israel is a, quote, Jewish state, but there is a non-Jewish part of the population. There is a Muslim, Christian, Arab population. What will they do in the upcoming elections? Will they participate? What are the problems facing the Arab parties in Israel?
Well, Palestinians actually make up, non-Jews actually make up the majority of the population here, but only a fraction of them are allowed to vote, participate in the elections. And there are four political parties that in the previous elections ran as a single bloc. This time they decided to break that bloc and run as separate parties. We'll wait and see. I mean, ideologically, these parties are very different. So, you know, some of them are socialists, some are neoliberal, and some are Islamists. So, I mean, it was a strange combination anyway. The only common denominator being that they are all Palestinians. And so we'll see what happens. I mean, the Palestinian voters have choices. We'll see what they choose. Either way, they don't make up more than about 10 or so percent of the members of the Knesset. And they are excluded from any coalition. They're excluded from any important vote, and they're excluded from all the important committees. So their presence there is really quite symbolic anyway.
We're speaking with Miko Peled. Last question, Miko. I mean, obviously, the Washington Post seems to be critical of Netanyahu's decision. Of course, the Washington Post, like the New York Times, like the Wall Street Journal, like all of the corporate-owned media in the United States, ardent supporters of Israel and Netanyahu over the years, no matter what crimes were committed. Maybe the Washington Post is just embarrassed now because of this open embrace with a party that you said is the equivalent, the Israeli equivalent of the Nazi party. You think that's what the problem is?
Yes, I think their problem is cosmetic. As long as that's their only problem, because Netanyahu is not going to change his policy. His policy has been just as radical and murderous against the Palestinians, and it will continue to do so. And in terms of the economy, they're not going to have an effect. He does what he wants anyway. And I think this is, it's the hypocrisy from the mainstream media about this, feigning this shock and horror that he's aligning himself with these neo-Nazis is hypocrisy, because he himself ideologically is no different than they are.
Last question. I said the last question was the last question, but this really is the last question because we have 45 seconds left. Are there any candidates in the Democratic Party who are running for president who offer a real alternative to Trump's orientation?
Well, it's very difficult to say at this point. I think the only person that may offer the prospect of change, and that is if we all of us who are really progressive work very, very hard, is Bernie Sanders. I think Bernie Sanders is at a point where he could end up being a supporter of BDS, a supporter of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. He could provide a real alternative, but I very, very strongly doubt that he will have the kind of momentum that he had in the previous elections. All of the others, I wouldn't expect any serious change on this issue.
That was the voice of Miko Peled. We were talking to Miko from Bethlehem. Miko is the author of The General Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled also has the new book, Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
The fight against ISIS in the final piece of territory it controls in Syria continues to drag on as hundreds of civilians flee the battlefield. Meanwhile, a major political controversy has erupted over whether or not citizens of countries like the UK or the United States who joined ISIS, including some who were children at the time, will be allowed to return home. We're joined from the UK by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria. Peter Ford, welcome back.
It's good to be back, Brian. Thank you.
Thank you. We consider you to be our Syrian prophet or our prophet on Syria because so much of what you have told us over the course of many, many months in terms of assessing the current situation or the current situation as it's evolved in Syria has turned out to be right. And I want to just get your assessment now. I'm looking at a headline from Al Jazeera. Hundreds evacuated from ISIL's, that's ISIS, last Syria holdout. SDF, that's the Syrian Democratic Forces, say civilian evacuation was not completed on Thursday, despite earlier expectations that it would be. Anyway, where are we right now in this war?
Well, ISIS is, to all intents and purposes, finished as a territory-controlling force. This holdout village is just that, a village, and the number of remaining fighters is in the low hundreds. There's a snag at the last minute because of the number of civilians that they've been keeping back as hostages. They've been bartering prisoners for food. But really, these are the dregs now, the holdout. It can surely only be a matter of a few days before we can draw a line under the caliphate as a territory. But of course, ISIS are not going to disappear. They've largely gone underground, and this is the next phase of the struggle, which needs to be carried out by the two governments of Iraq and Syria, which have been the main targets of ISIS activity. We always tend to think that everything is about us. It's all about us in the West. But ISIS, their main objectives were to carve out a caliphate in the territory of Iraq and Syria. And most of their victims, contrary to the impression you might get reading our media, the vast majority of their victims have been Syrians and Iraqis. And this has implications for justice for those who carried out the atrocities.
As the region and the world moves into this sort of post-ISIS period or post-ISIS as a territory-controlling organization period, there are a number of both economic and political decisions that have to be made. Let's start with reconstruction before we move on to some of the political decisions about people who are returning from these territories. How will people get back to normal life in these areas that have been so devastated by ISIS and also by the U.S. bombing campaign that's been going on without the permission of the sovereign Syrian government since 2015?
Well, first of all, it needs security stabilization. As I mentioned, ISIS have gone underground. Just today, 14 oil workers were killed, assassinated. It looks like an ISIS job. And incidents like this are going on all the time, even more so in Iraq. So what's needed is for a strong central government authority in Baghdad and in Damascus to be allowed to exercise that authority and get a grip of the security situation. That's the number one requirement. And that is the one thing that the Western government will not accept in the case of Syria. They are refusing to allow the Assad government to take that control of its own territory. And therefore, they are de facto accomplices of these ISIS dregs who've gone underground.
Yeah, Peter Ford, I'm always struck by media accounts in the Western media, especially the U.S. media. I'm not in the U.K. I read a little bit of your media, but not that much. But I'm always struck by the formulations like Assad threatens to seize former ISIS territory or something like that without helping the audience understand that the territory that it would be, quote, seizing would be its own territory. It's kind of like Syria and the Assad government invading Syria. But nonetheless, these are the kind of formulations that are routine. And I have to say, I'm struck by the fact that people who are traditionally, or at least during the Iraq War, would have been anti-war and considered themselves liberal or progressive and anti-war, don't seem to object to some of these formulations, as if the government of Syria has no right to be in Syria.
Exactly. This is the new Orientalism, as it was made famous by, you know, the academic Edward Said. Our myopic, navel-gazing Western way of looking at the Middle East as our playground and ignoring the rights and the identity on the sovereignty of the people it belongs to. We're entirely focused on ourselves, and it claims that the withdrawal of U.S. troops will lead to a vacuum is a case in point. It won't lead to a vacuum at all. It will lead to a situation where hopefully the forces, the security forces of the Syrian government will be able to go in and take back control and give the people of the area stability and security.
There's been a lot of controversy in the U.S. media today and among U.S. politicians about the case of Huda Mutana. She was 19. She traveled to Syria to live in ISIS's caliphate. I mean, once the Syrian civil war broke out in 2011, a process, by the way, we should always note, was fostered and supported by the United States and its regional allies every step of the way. You know, once that war broke out, it became a magnet for many people. Huda Mutana was one of them. She was 19 when she arrived. She's now renounced her views and wants to come home. There's another high-profile case in the UK of a girl who went to join ISIS when she was only 15 years old. What's the ramifications of this question? I mean, what are the different considerations the politicians are making? What are the judicial and legal qualifications that need to be taken into consideration too?
And the U.S. government's position is somebody who is an American born in the United States can't come back to the United States. I don't understand the legal part of that.
Well, the position in international law is very clear. It is illegal for a government to make someone stateless. You can strip someone of their nationality, but only provided they got another nationality to fall back on. And it appears in the case of this girl, Huda, that she only had U.S. nationality, although she's, I think, of Somali origin. And there's a similar parallel case in the U.K. with a girl called Shamima Begum, who was of Bangladeshi parentage, but she only has British nationality, apparently. But of course, situations are always complicated. The British government are claiming that she could, if she applied, have Bangladeshi citizenship. And the Bangladeshi government are saying, oh, no, she can't. So it's all hideously complicated.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like a revival of the old medieval practice of exiling someone. You know, if you commit something, you know, commit a crime, right? You know, you can just be banished from the land forever.
Or not even a crime, because she's not charged with any crime.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, if she returned to the United States, if she was allowed to return to the United States, maybe the U.S. judicial system will go into motion there. But, you know, that's not what the Trump administration is saying. They're saying you can't come back.
Banished. You know, you mentioned Edward Said, Ambassador Ford. We have 2 minutes left. And, when Samuel Huffington formulated the clash of civilizations right after the attack on September 11th, to say that Islam in the West were at war because it was a clash of civilizations. Edward Said, the noted academic, Palestinian academic, wrote the article, "The Clash of Ignorance. Labels like, quote, Islam and, quote, the West serve only to confuse us about a disorderly reality." I thought that was very prescient at the time and still prescient. It's not a clash of civilizations. The problem in the United States is not a failure to understand the Muslim world. It's really about trying to dominate these resource-rich countries. At least that's the way I see it.
That's absolutely right. It's about a new imperialism, about the Western assumption that we have an automatic right to dictate to these countries, and we will not take it when some of them answer back, whether it's Iran, looking further afield, Venezuela, or Syria. That's absolutely right. But this business of the clash of civilization ignores another reality, and that is, if there's a clash in the Middle East in the last 20 years, it's been primarily between Muslims ISIS was fighting against the infidel, against the Syrian Shia in particular, Yazidis, Christians, other Middle East religions. And we should remind ourselves of this fact. It's not all about us. Important as we are, it's not all about us.
Those are wise words, Walter. Not all about us, because the Eurocentric, the US-centric view does just that. And as a consequence, it makes people ignorant. It makes people not understand the dynamic realities and the dynamic mechanisms of conflict in the world. Anyway, we're out of time for the moment. We were joined from the United Kingdom by Ambassador Peter Ford. He is the former UK ambassador to Syria. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. It's time again for our regular weekly segment called Veterans for Peace, where we discuss contemporary issues of war and peace that affect veterans, their families, active duty service members, and the country as a whole. We're joined every week from California by Jerry Condon. Jerry is a Vietnam-era veteran and a war resister who has been a peace and solidarity activist for almost 50 years, currently serving as national president of the organization Veterans for Peace. Jerry Condon, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be here. It's a pretty busy week. Veterans for Peace has joined in protests all over the country. Tomorrow and Saturday, especially Saturday, there's like protests against the U.S. orchestrated coup in Venezuela taking place. Actually, the latest I saw was in over 100 cities around the U.S. and around the world. So that's really critically important. And while things seem to be coming to a head in Venezuela at the same time, I mean, the same day that the protests were called for on Saturday, the 23rd, is the day that the self-appointed so-called president of Venezuela, Juan Guaido, is called as the day when he would try to force U.S. humanitarian aid across the border from Colombia into Venezuela. In the meantime, I guess tomorrow, Friday, there's going to be like dueling concerts on both sides of the border. This Sir Richard Branson, the billionaire, is funding kind of his version of Live Aid to raise. He says he wants to raise $100 million for humanitarian aid for Venezuela. Of course, that would go to the opposition, and he's apparently enabled. Been able to recruit some top talent, Peter Gabriel and several Latin superstars for that concert. And now the Venezuelan government is also sponsoring a concert that will happen just on the other side of the border. It's now going to be right on the bridge, I think, between Colombia and Venezuela, the bridge that where the U.S. is amassing humanitarian aid as a political weapon on the other side. And this is really, you know, incredibly cynical use of humanitarian aid, and the International Red Cross and I believe the United Nations and other international aid organizations have said they will not participate in that aid effort because it's obviously a political stunt to put more pressure on the Maduro government and to justify U.S. intervention.
That's the voice of Jerry Condon. Yes, Jerry, you are right. This is a political stunt. You know, here you have the United States imposing very, very severe economic sanctions on Venezuela. It's been the Venezuelan economy has lost maybe $30 billion even in recent times because of sanctions. And then the same people who are imposing the sanction, thus depriving Venezuelans of food and medicine, then say, well, open your border and let us, the governments that are trying to overthrow you, come in and show our tender concern for the human beings who have already had suffering inflicted on them by our own economic policies. I mean, it's such obviously a political stunt. It's also, in a way, a Trojan horse, because what they're trying to do is get in, because once in, they want to be able to do what the so-called coup effort has failed to do so far, which is to actually topple the government. I'm looking at an article that you sent to us, Jerry. It's from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And they do a really interesting breakdown of some statistics and demographics about hunger and hungry people in Venezuela. I want to read a paragraph out loud and then have you comment about it. In June 2013, The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, included Venezuela in a group of 18 nations that had cut the number of hungry people by half in the preceding 20 years, 14 of which were governed by Chavismo, that's Hugo Chavez. The FAO said that Venezuela reduced the number of people suffering from malnutrition from 13.5% of the population in 1990 to 92 to less than 5% in 2010 to 2012. I mean, these are dramatic reductions of poverty and hunger. And at the same time, the Venezuelan government has built 2.5 million houses for working class and poor families free of charge. 2.5 million out of a population of 30 million. So if you approximated the same ratio to the United States, that would be like the U.S. government building like 30 million houses and giving them away for free to working class families. I mean, and then you have these same imperial powers saying, oh, there's a humanitarian crisis and only we can come and help. I mean, it's the hypocrisy is staggering.
Right. And they're actually stepping up. The Trump administration is actually stepping up sanctions at this very time and other forms of economic warfare to make sure that that Venezuela isn't able to get any international loans to rebuild the infrastructure of its oil industry, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, it's very hypocritical. And then the media coverage is, as Fair points out, and this is a really important article, I think, on the Fair website that you're referencing there by Gregory Shupak, U.S. media erases years of Chavismo's gains. Everything in the U.S. media is about the Venezuelan government and the Bolivarian revolution. It's totally negative, and none of these positives are being shared. And then you have, you know, we're kind of used to that, but it's pretty disgusting how one-sided it is, even on the places like NPR and PBS. But then, you know, yesterday we saw Amnesty International chiming in, you know, what's up with Amnesty International? They do some very important work. They do some good reports that are important about human rights violations around the world. And they have a great reputation. At one point they had the Nobel Peace Prize, I believe. But, you know, almost like clockwork, there'll be an Amnesty International report timed to support U.S. regime change operations, as was the case in Syria. And now in Venezuela, they came out with a report that's totally one-sided condemnation of the Venezuelan government for its repression of dissent. So, you know, you gotta wonder what's going on with Venezuela. What's going on with Amnesty International? You know, a lot of the I understand that a lot of former State Department people have moved over there. It's almost like they're schizophrenic. They have like one section that does really good work and they have another section that's run by the CIA.
Yes, I hear you on that. In the run-up to the Iraq War in 1991, they played a principal part in promoting false, completely lying accounts about Iraq in Kuwait, which turned out to be not true, but painted a demonized picture of Iraq, which then, you know, basically prepared the American people to accept that George H.W. Bush was going to have an unnecessary, gross war of aggression against Iraq as opposed to a negotiated settlement. Jerry, time is running short. You mentioned the February 23rd protests. These are protests that are going on all across the United States and around the world this weekend. People can go to nowaronvenezuela.org. I believe that's the website where you can find out about a demo in your area. On March 16th, the Answer Coalition and many, many other groups here in Washington are sponsoring a national march on the White House. Again, a larger and larger number of people in this country are saying to the Trump administration and to the Democratic elites who are supporting him, you guys might speak in our name, but you're doing so without our consent. We don't support the idea that the U.S. government can determine who the president of Venezuela is, and we certainly don't want another war. Veterans for Peace is right in there. Just talk about how veterans themselves perceive this kind of endless marching off to war when, of course, the people making the orders, they don't have to march themselves, but they send other people to do it.
Veterans are tired of it. You know, we started mobilizing against the U.S. Contra war in Nicaragua back in the 80s and the war in El Salvador. We didn't want to see another Vietnam War in Central America. And now it's on and on. It's more of the same. We have veterans mobilizing all over the country right now and internationally. And one of the international events, by the way, this Friday and Saturday is going to be in Tijuana, Mexico, organized by the Veterans for Peace chapter of deported veterans, you know, people who served in the U.S. wars and then were subsequently deported because they weren't citizens and they got in a little bit of trouble with the law. So we have a very vital chapter down there. So they're having an event on Friday night with asylum, Central America asylum seekers. They've invited me to come down and speak about the what's going on in Venezuela. And then we're going to have an event right at the border wall between Tijuana and San Diego on Saturday morning, making the connections between U.S. intervention in throughout Latin America and the flood of desperate asylum seekers that are seeking to get into the United States. So those are important connections that veterans are making. And I'm really very excited, actually, that the peace movement and certainly the veterans peace movement is responding strongly to this open threat of a U.S. coup in Venezuela.
Yeah, Jerry, when you look at the big picture, it looked at first that all the momentum was with the coup makers. It seems like the pendulum has shifted right now. Things are stable in Venezuela, but Trump, Bolton, Pence, Pompeo, they're determined. I think it makes the danger of a real U.S. war or a proxy war even more likely. 30 seconds left. What's your take?
Yeah, I agree. It seems like their initial attempt to somehow get the military to fall on their side. I mean, Trump actually openly called out on the Venezuelan military to come to his side today, and they kind of angrily mocked him and said, you got to be kidding. You know, we're Venezuelans. We're not part of the U.S. military. But, you know, I think the fact that the coup doesn't seem to be going so favorably so far does, in fact, increase the risk that there'll be direct U.S. military intervention and or the initiation of a Contra-type war, because we see the U.S. Has been dropping arms in various places around Venezuela, apparently. And also, of course, Colombia, which is kind of the Israel of South America and now a NATO member, could be actively involved in a military intervention.
We'll leave it right there. That was the voice of Jerry Condon. He is the president of the Veterans for Peace. This is a weekly segment called Veterans for Peace. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, between 4 and 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.